Hello and welcome to The Frequency of Laughter, a show about the history of radio comedy. I'm Grace Den, and this week we're looking in particular at the early 1980s. I'm joined by two people who were making very different programmes at that time. Angus Deaton, who was writing and performing in the sketch show Radio Active, which transferred to BBC Two as KYTV. And Michael Knowles, who after adapting Dad's Army for radio, wrote the 1983 sitcom It Sticks Out Half a Mile with Harold Snowd, effectively a Dad's Army sequel. During the show, we'll be playing in some excerpts from the programmes we're talking about, as well as contributions from some other people who were around at the time. But I started by asking Angus about one of the first points on his CV, being awarded the BBC Radio Comedy Writers' Bursary in 1980.
I've never heard it referred to as a bursary.
My bursary.
Before.
I don't know where that word's come from. What did you call it?
Writer's contract, I think. Which is, basically, they paid you for a year. That was kind of, they kept you on a retainer for a year, which was a way of stopping you, you know, going off into other industries, I suppose, because no one really knew what they were going to do at that stage. I mean, you had people working in that department when I started, like, you know, Geoffrey Perkins and Griffiths Jones, Rory McGrath, you know what they went on to do. But at the time, no one really knew whether they were going to be a performer or writer or a plumber, you know.
Did you have an office here? Did you have a desk in the BBC?
No. How it actually worked, although it was supposed to encourage you to write for Weekending and Jason Explanation and News Headlines and all the shows that were going on at the time, what it actually resulted in was you thinking, oh, great, I'm being paid for the next year. I don't really need to do anything. I'll just put my feet up or go off and write a stage show, which is what we were actually doing with Radioactive. It allowed you to, in theory, work as a writer rather than having to work as a writer at the same time as delivering Meals on Wheels or a paper round or whatever else, because that's what most people were doing. They were working as writers, but they also had another job.
First off this afternoon, here's an urgent piece of traffic news from our traffic department and Mike Cable. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Anna.
How's Trix?
Oh, she's fine.
Terrific. Well, thanks very much, Mike.
Bye, Anna.
Michael, as an actor who then turned to writing, do you wish that you'd swapped to that earlier? Do you wish that you'd gone straight?
No. I had no ambitions at all. I mean, I fell into writing, I suppose, to make money. Because my wife suddenly gave birth to twins. Well, suddenly we knew it was going to happen.
Yeah. That would be odd. She suddenly gave birth to twins. And you haven't even noticed.
No. And I could see ahead of me 20-odd years of schooling and so forth. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just see if I can do something.
That's an awful lot of money.
I know. But it's a sort of business venture. Oh, please, Uncle Arthur, it's a chance of a lifetime.
Yes, well, that may well be, but there's really no way...
Please, Uncle Arthur.
All right. Well, I suppose there's no harm in taking down a few details.
No, that's right.
Right, now, purpose of loan.
I want to buy Framborne Pier.
Uh-huh. Wants to buy Framborne Pier.
I always feel sort of an interloper, because I don't consider myself a writer. I maybe have a facility with dialogue, but I'm no good at plots and storylines. But that was Harold Snowd's... That was his department, really, when the two of us were writing together.
It's interesting that you still feel like that, though, Michael, because you've written thousands and thousands of words.
But, yeah, I know, but I look around at people who are proper writers, like yourself, write novels. I thought, I'm not in that class. All I can do is you know, scribble a bit of dialogue, and that seems to work. Don't forget, I was in rep for about 4 years when I left Rada. So you... If you're doing weekly rep particularly, you're doing a play a week. So after 4 or 5 years, you've got several hundred scripts in your head. Peter Ustinov say it's like a computer. So when you write a line, you instinctively know how it should sound because you've had all this pumped into you over the years.
Do you drift into radio? Well, tell me about the first time that you wrote this first script.
Well, we started writing sketches for Bill Pertwee and Mike and Bernie Winters, things like that. And I was in Jimmy Perry's rep at Watford. That's how it started. A bit of nepotism here, because we all had the same agent, Richard Stone. And when this came up, they wanted the radio of Dad's Army. Jimmy and Dave said, we're too busy, we can't do it. So they said, what about you two?
Godfrey, what is that peculiarly shaped object stuck in your hat?
It's his head.
Because Harold was also a producer, had been a producer on Dad's Army. So they said, well, do a pilot for us. So we took the first episode and presented it to them. They liked it. And that was it. We were off. 69
episodes. 69 episodes. How much adaptation did it need?
So well, an enormous amount, actually.
You were essentially rewriting finished shows.
Yes, but radio needs a lot of words. I mean, in television, you've got reaction shots. You don't need dialogue. Mm. You can say things with just a picture. Mm. But radio, you need the words. And also with radio, you need jokes. I used to annoy him. The press used to say, oh, what did you do, take the soundtrack off and just put it on? I said, no, it wasn't quite like that. Mm. Some things, they were so visual that we had to write an enormous amount to make it into a possible script.
Well, what do you think of my big toes?
Oh, my dear. They do look nasty.
Right. Now, it's my contention, Wilson, that this is due entirely to active service.
What? Well, ingrown toenails.
Precisely.
Somebody told me that in the first episodes you had everybody in uniform.
Yes. Well, that was John Dyers. He's a marvellous ex-producer, but he did go over the top a bit. And the first series said, you must all have your uniforms on. But that only lasted for it. That was for the audience to look at, of course.
I'm going to ask you about some names that heads of department around this era. Bobby J. What sort of figure was he?
He was a very jovial sort and a very likeable man, Bobby J. But the one overriding memory I have of him was getting us into the office after a rude word had gone out in Radioactive. And
how rude was it?
these days, it's probably relatively innocuous, to be honest. In fact, there are guidelines as to how to use this word in the BBC even now, because you can use the word with the expression with rain to mean heavy downpour. Yeah. You can occasionally use it in the past tense to mean drunk, but the one time you can never use it is to mean urinate. And I can remember Bobby J getting me into the office and saying, listeners do not want piss coming out of their radios at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. But we'd got into trouble before because the way round writing obscenities is to write it in such a way that it doesn't appear in the script. So we had a throat lozenge, I remember, called Quillies.
If you feel down in the mouth...
Suck Quillies, they make your mouth feel great.
But before you go out in the morning, stick Quillies in your pocket.
And because it was looked completely innocuous on the page, it went out on Radio 4 and no-one batted an eyelid.
So Bobby J didn't pick up on that one?
No, he didn't. No, no. Or one of the characters called Michael Hunt. He was obviously abbreviated. Actually, he did pick up on that one, on that last one, and got us into the office and said, do you realise when this man's first name is abbreviated, it's quite rude? And we said, yes, but it has been going out for 4 series now. So he had to give in.
I'm going to give you another name. Martin Fisher.
Yes, yes, Martin, yes.
Now, Martin produced It Sticks Out Half a Mile. He went on to become a head of department. Have you got memories of working with Martin?
Yes, well, nice chap, I know.
How much... input would someone like Martin have on your work, though? I mean, how
would you mean on radio?
Yeah. I mean, was he tremendously involved?
Yes, yes. Oh, yes, he was. Yes, not so much as our previous director, that was John Dyers, but yes, Martin was fine. Yes.
My name's Martin Fisher. I joined the BBC in 1959 as a trainee studio manager, and ground my way up to being a producer in Light Entertainment Radio, as it was then called, and eventually head of the department in 1984, and stayed there until 1990, and ended the last 3 years of my career as head of comedy and television. I only came in because the series had a sort of albatross hanging over it, like in The Ancient Mariner. What happened was that the pilot was recorded, and then... the producer of the original pilot became ill and was taken off what might have been the series at the time. And then, to make things worse, Arthur Lowe, as Captain Mannering, sadly died. And so the whole pilot had to be scrapped. I got a request, I think it must have been from Bobby J, who was head of the department, would I take over the series, which was commissioned. And instead of Arthur Lowe's character, Bill Pertwee's character Hodges, the ARP warden, was drafted in, and so we went ahead with him, John LeMessurier and Ian Lavender. It was very pleasant. All the casts were very cooperative and helpful, and it went very well. So I had no problems at all with actually recording the series, and they went out and they were quite popular. But sadly, again, as I was editing, and it's typical, it was the 13th episode, 13 being unlucky, I got the news that John LeMessurier had died, and that spelt the end of a second series which had already been commissioned, and the whole enterprise, in Private Fraser's words, John Laurie, we were all doomed.
I mean, my memory of all the executives is that the main aim with any programme was that no one complained about it. That was regarded as success.
Yes.
It was very much, you know, it went out and we got away with it. You know, there weren't any letters in green ink from retired colonels in Cheltenham. And that was, you know, that was a successful show.
Looking at BBC comedy and the intimacy of radio, I think there was always a sort of carefulness about what might harm or shock an audience, because radio, without the visual image, I think has the power to shock more than television. And I think it was inbred in all new producers, the collegiate atmosphere that existed in the BBC at that time, that you followed what had gone before you. And there was a certain carefulness in what was allowed out and what wasn't. But writers and some producers always wanted to push the boundaries at the time, and they used to often sneak into scripts material that perhaps wouldn't have been allowed if they'd told anyone about it before it went out. There was the example of The Goon Show back in the 50s, where Michael Benteen invented a character called Captain Hugh Jampton, which, if you know your Cockney rhyming slang, Hampton equals Hampton Wick. So it was always there.
They just took forever to make any decision, irrespective of who you're talking about. We did our pilot show of Radioactive. It took a year for them to decide whether we should have a series or not. And then after we'd done our series, I remember one of the executives, it may have been Bobby J, saying, OK, well, that's commercial radio. What would you do if we gave you a second series? And we thought, well, the same again. That's the idea of it. It's a parody of commercial radio. And indeed, they're very sniffy about it and weren't very keen. And then I think we got given a Sony Award, and suddenly we were the blue-eyed boys of the department, and, you know, please have a second series. So they're quite easily led.
How did that feel?
Well, it was great. I mean, it was sort of, because you weren't quite sure if it was any good until that moment. You sort of hoped it was, but you didn't really know. Audiences were laughing, but, you know, it's not quite the same. And so to be given an award by your peers sort of meant it was a seal of approval. You know, you felt as if, OK, right, we're here now.
Well, that shouldn't be difficult. She works for the council in forward planning.
We haven't touched on the studio audiences. Before the audience came in, we sat at the foot of the stairs and you could see them coming down, and you could always tell by what was coming down the stairs what the reaction was going to be like. I mean, once we had an audience of almost entirely Japanese, so we recorded it to silence. And then a lot of Scandinavians came, and they were a bit slow. But you could always tell, you know, with, oh, no, no. And if they were very old coming down, oh, God, no, they're not going to get this. You know.
We had the same two old ladies that always sat in the front row.
Yes, that's right. Mm, yes.
Joyce and someone, I can't remember.
Every
single show. But it was great, the Paris studios. We used to do the read-through in the narrator's suite, as they called it.
That's right.
Which was where Churchill had broadcast his speeches during the Second World War.
Yes.
Which were slightly funnier than some of the scripts we did, I have to say.
That's right.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin.
The read-throughs with Dad's arm were quite amusing sometimes, because the actors would find their favourite bits, because it's not the television script, have gone. Where's that line gone? Well, I used to say this here. Well, sorry, it's a different story now. And then some of the older actors, like John Lurie, said, rubbish, loose writing. You get a lot of that coming at you. You had to get used to it in the end. Yes, it was fun, but nothing much was changed. It was too late by then in the afternoon.
Hello, playwrights! Hi, thank you. Can you smell mothballs?
1979 saw the opening of the Comedy Store. 1982, The Young Ones and the comic strip begin. They just bypassed radio. Was there a sense in the BBC of, what, hang on a minute, why were they? Why did we not have them? Or did you not care?
I think they looked at the BBC Light Entertainment Department and thought that it was sort of full of Oxbridge, what is the polite word, idiots, and thought, well, why do we bother? They had very successful stage shows, and so it was a very sort of visual medium that they seemed to be working in, so why not transfer that to TV? And I suppose they kind of bypassed, they didn't really need radio as a stepping stone. And so things, shows like The Young Ones and later Alexis Show were immediate sort of mainstream hits. And I think they were probably quite right to do that. And also, they can kind of get away with slightly more, I think, on TV, whereas with radio, you really, you know, to take an alternative comics act and put it on radio, you'd have to take out all the swear words, and then you're only basically left with good evening and thanks a lot, good night.
This is Peter Richardson. The comic strip show, it wasn't just a sound show, it was visual, but also we did make a record, and we were managed by a guy called Martin Lewis, who Alexi brought in, who was determined that we should all, you know, make a fortune out of selling albums. You know, when you think of that time, there was a lot of people like Derek and Clive Live in the 70s that never went near radio because it was far too filthy, and, you know, I suppose radio has always had certain standards, and they still don't drop below them in terms of, you know, you get away with the F word on television much more than you would on, in fact you never hear it on radio as far as I can see. So it did go out on an album for I think it was Iron Records. But to answer your question, why did we never go on the radio? Well, the truth is that BBC came down to the Comic Strip Boulevard Theatre where we were doing our show and recorded the show for BBC Two. So somewhere in your archives, we have the show. It's just you never transmitted it. That's the truth. So the reason we're not on radio is you didn't put it out.
Angus, it feels like you're telling me this. It's quite a good arrangement, really, because you've got you and your friends here in the BBC, and then you've got the Comedy Store people, and you don't really want to be there, and they don't want to be here. But in reality, it's like a mile apart, isn't it? You're really only about...
Yes.
It's really only down Regent Street, but never the twain seem to meet. It's quite interesting.
They probably met eventually. Radioactive actually used to appear in the comic strip as part of the comic strip evening, which was almost entirely alternative comics and us. It took place in the Raymond Review Bar, I seem to remember, in London, Soho. So you went up the stairs, if you turned left, you got us. If you turned right, you got a very different show indeed. And we were kind of, a carrot and a cabbage patch. It was odd for us to be there because we were kind of establishment and I think quite staid compared with their show. But they very kindly invited us, so we took our 40 quid a week and said thanks very much.
Because there seems to be this sense that just at the point when The Young Ones was starting, Arthur Askey was still making his last show for Radio 2, but, you know, these two types of comedy were very much working together.
I can remember Aid Emerson saying that he'd gone into a BBC party with Jennifer, and said, you know, so where are all the June Whitfields and Terry Scott? And Jennifer said, well, we're them now. and that's kind of what happens, is that, you know, that young, thrusting, anarchic comic then becomes, you know, establishment.
But when you get here, did you feel aware that that everybody was kind of like you? Does it strike you that there was nobody that was, you know, like me? does it ever strike you that, or I do find it fascinating, the idea of the alternative comedy coming along and kind of smashing that idea to pieces.
It's somebody from up north, you mean, as opposed to
somebody from up north, literally, whatever, shouting and being coarse. Were you aware that everything was quite lovely for people coming through from Oxford and Cambridge?
Oxbridge boys. Yes, if you're alluding to a sort of Oxbridge mafia, then absolutely right. Yes, that's exactly what it was. Yes, I suppose there had been this sort of history of through, you know, the Pythons and I'm sorry again, and the goodies and all that sort of automatic transfer there seemed to be after people had done the Footlights at the Edinburgh Festival or the Oxford Review, that they would expect some kind of a job at the BBC Light Entertainment Department, and that's sort of almost exactly what happened.
But there's always been this tradition of getting into the theatre, either through the university, through Oxbridge. I had the choice, am I going to Cambridge? My housemaster said, I'm putting you down for Magdalen. In those days, you couldn't do that. I said, oh, no, so I'm going to RADA. So you had that, and I think it still pertains, that you can go in that way or the other way.
But did it feel at the time, like, in a lovely way for you, did it feel like a closed shop?
Well, I'm not sure it was that lovely, because in some respect it suddenly became very unfashionable, and that the smart thing was to have not gone to Oxford and Cambridge and to be a stand-up comic who swore a lot. But, you know, they were very successful, and they were the ones who were very angry and, you know, took up the sort of political cudgel and left us alone, really, because we weren't really interested in satirising that sort of side of society.
Radioactive mass debate.
There's a nuclear debate on Radioactive. Did the political environment of the early 1980s affect what you were doing?
If I'm honest, no, not really. And I think Radioactive, I remember being criticised by one critic who said that, you know, it wasn't politically satirical. And I thought it was always rather odd, because we never set out to be politically satirical. We satirised the media, I suppose, so it was a kind of social satire, but it wasn't really politically satirical. And it's odd what people regard as politically satirical in terms of shows. Because, I mean, things like Not the 9 o'clock News is always regarded as a sort of, you know, political satire. But most of that, if you think about the most famous moments, they're Rowan dressed as a gorilla or Rowan walking into a lamppost. You know, it had one or two political references that were kind of sprinkled in after they'd shot most of the sketches. And the same with Radioactive. It had a few sort of topical references, but it really wasn't a political show, and it wasn't a sort of angry political show.
Did you feel that ever there was pressure writing your comedy to be satirical? Did you ever sit down and think, oh, we should really tackle the Falklands, we should tackle the miners, we really should be thinking of something very
slightly more worthy to attack than Sky Television, which is what we ended up doing on KYTV. Yes, I think you're right. I think we probably should have, but that's sort of style of comedy, that area of comedy, is oddly enough never really appealed to me, or given what I ended up doing. But I don't really feel a particularly political animal, and I never really wrote political jokes. They were much more broadly comic, and I've always thought that's actually a much more difficult task. I think writing gags about politicians is not that difficult compared with sort of creating a character and finding, you know, ways in which those characters can interact. I think that's the more difficult.
Michael, you spent a lot of time with people who worked in TV. Mm-hmm. Did you discuss radio with them at all? I mean, these were TV stars. Did they ever think about radio, think about going to work in radio? Or was that something very much that you kind of, once you leapfrogged to TV, you didn't?
No, there's no snobbery in that sense. No, and don't forget, they were very glad to do it, because it's a very useful way of earning money for the actors. You know, they haven't got to learn anything. The scripts are there. No. And Jimmy and David used to come to the broadcasts when we recorded them, yeah. Used to say, I don't remember it being as funny as that, which we always took as being a feather in our caps.
I'll say that to Angus. What is the attitude of TV people to radio?
Well, it's very different these days. In the early 80s, they didn't really know what was going on radio, and I'm not sure they were that bothered. I think we'd had about 7 or 8 series of Radioactive, and I think I wrote to the head of TV comedy and got a letter back addressed to Mr. Deegtoe, saying this idea is completely implausible. So I didn't really bother anymore.
Good evening and welcome to It's Your Round, the show where every game has been invented by the contestants themselves. It's a daring concept, as you never know what's coming or whether it'll work, much like buying stuff on eBay when you're drunk.
Angus, you didn't do any radio between the end of Radioactive...
This sounds like you're telling me off.
..and the... I want to talk to you about this.
Right.
..and the 25th anniversary special in 2002.
Yes.
And then It's Your Round in 2011. Where did you go?
I went to the land of television, I suppose, and I don't think it was any particular reason why I didn't do radio. I'm not sure I got offered that much until It's Your Round came along, and I thought that was actually a genuinely innovative idea, and still do. I've always said that radio is actually the more fun of the two mediums. Unless you actually wanted the exposure and the money and the fame and all the rest of it, everyone would work in radio. But the thing is that most people feel as if the next step is to work on TV. So I guess that's why people end up doing it. Obviously, it's much better paid, and people regard it as the ultimate achievement is to be successful on TV, whether that's correct or not.
So no more Radioactive. Ever.
Well, we did have lunch together the other day. There was talk of a reunion, but it may happen. I mean, obviously, we've lost a large part of Radioactive in Jeffrey Perkins, who was so instrumental and was sort of, you know, our mentor. So it would be difficult to do anything now he's not around anymore. But, you know, never say never. Might do.
Well, I just don't want to be bombed.
Have you ever been bombed?
Well, that's not the point.
Have you ever been bombed?
No, but...
And how do you know you don't want to be, then?
Well, obviously...
Quite like it. A lot of chaps in the last war quite took to it. Said it gave them a chance to find out just what sort of stuff they were made of.
Look, I know...
Michael, So, you didn't return to radio after the TV version of High and Dry went out. Did you write other things after that, or...?
I think I had a stab at one or two things and sent the scripts in, but there were different people then, different... I didn't know most of the people, so I used to get comments like from one producer. He said, it gave me a nasty feeling of marmalade behind my knees. I never worked it out. But also the other one, this is too much like something we've never done before.
So
it's too avant-garde.
Hang on.
So I didn't bother doing any more after that.
You just have to nod, I think.
Yes.
Thank you to Michael Knowles and Angus Deaton. That was The Frequency of Laughter, presented by me, Grace Dent, with Angus Deaton and Michael Knowles, and Martin Fisher and Peter Richardson. A list of the clips we've used is on the Radio 4 website. The producers were Ed Morrish and Alexandra Smith.